Today, we live here in this country in the world's most affluent nation. And you would think, with this very high level of material prosperity that we have, that we would be happy, perhaps the happiest people in the world. The fact is, we are not. Here in this country, we suffer almost epidemic rates of stress and anxiety and depression. What's going on here? That is the question that we'll explore this morning in this part of Focus 580. And our guest for the program is Peter Weibra. He is a physician and psychiatrist. He's on faculty of University of California, Los Angeles, and is author of a newly published book that's titled American Mania, When More Is Not Enough. It's published by W.W. Norton. And here is what he writes in the introduction to the book. He writes, "Never before in history, in the history of our species, have so many enjoyed so much. This extraordinary accomplishment has brought America to the leading edge of an unusual human experiment. Building on a philosophical foundation of unbridled self-interest and commercial freedom, and supercharged now by a revolution in information technology, we've built a dynamic society of tantalizing appeal. But the resulting mix of technology, affluence, and competitive social challenge that we have created for ourselves is radically different from the natural world in which our species rose to dominance some 200,000 years ago. That radical difference in social habitat has fostered a craving and an acquisitive behavior in America that are now testing the limits of our ancestral biology in mind and body and eroding the foundations of our community. In short, in our compulsive drive for more, we are making ourselves sick." Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest, Peter Weibra. He is director of the Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's also the Judson Braun Distinguished Professor and Executive Chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Biobehavioral Sciences at the Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. Before going to UCLA, he was Professor and Chairman of Psychiatry at University of Pennsylvania. He is an international authority on depression and manic depressive disease. He's authored a number of books in addition to the one that we have mentioned, and we'll talk about one of his other books titled A Mood Apart, The Thinker's Guide to Emotion and Its Disorder. And he's talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, comments are welcome, as always. The only thing we ask of people who call into the show is that they just try to be brief so that we can get in as many callers as possible, keep the program moving. Anyone, though, is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And the local number, 333-9455. At any point here, your questions are certainly welcome. Dr. Weibrow, hello.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
We certainly appreciate it. Well, as you note in the book, and as we know, America now today enjoys a very high level of material well-being, and we also know the prices that we have paid for that. We have people working very, very hard and have paid the price with their family relationships. As I said, people report very high levels of anxiety and stress, and we know that in order to support this kind of lifestyle, there are a lot of people who have very high levels of debt. So we have a lot of problems, and we can talk about them in a little bit more detail. But just to deal with the point that you make right up front, in looking for answers, when people ask this question, well, what got us to this point?
Right.
There are two sort of conventional explanations. One has to do with human failing, and the other has to do with the power of marketing. That is, people say, well, maybe it's just we're weak, essentially, and we can't. We don't have the strength to know what's good for us and to recognize the good and to go for that. And the other is to acknowledge the power of advertising and marketing and the ability of people who have things to sell to convince us that we should have this, that we'll be happier if we buy it. You find both of those explanations unsatisfactory.
Yes, I think they're partially contributing, obviously, but they're really, they don't go to the heart of the matter. In fact, what I try to do in the book is to emphasize that this isn't really a moral issue. It's an issue which relates to the way in which we're wired up as creatures of this planet. In fact, it's therefore a predictable circumstance. If you reward a creature such as ourselves excessively, they will essentially become addicted to that reward cycle. And the only thing that keeps us from running away to greed, this was well known in the 18th century when this great nation was founded, is the community that in which one lives. It's the empathy and the compassion that one learns as a child that enables us to rein in the wonderful, seductive environment in which we now live. And the thesis of the book is to try to add to the debate, because I think in framing it, as you very accurately said earlier, we miss the important point, which is that if we redesigned our society just a little bit to recognize that we have to have social reinvestment as well as individual reward, I think we would be doing a lot better. We are pushing people to their limits. I was just reading the New York Times at breakfast, and there's a front page article about young people, young athletes who are training nonstop, are creating for themselves extraordinary physical disabilities at a very early age. In their teens, they're developing all sorts of problems which sometimes actually take them out of the race. Our society has become so competitive, so demanding of excellence. You know, other athletes are taking steroids to enhance their performance. In all areas of society, we're seeing this push to the edge. And that push to the edge, I think, is genuinely beginning to test our physiological limits in terms of the way we're put together.
Mm. It's interesting that there's a figure in this book that's very important, and that is Adam Smith. And perhaps not surprising when we're talking about the competitive drive that people have and the desire to produce and consume. He's perhaps the patron saint of American capitalism. And indeed, he did write about that desire to compete was an engine that drives economy, drives society, and he did indeed say that he thought that that was a positive thing.
Absolutely.
However, what you point out, and I think perhaps what some people maybe miss, is that he said that unrestricted, that is not a positive thing, and recognized the danger of what happens when that drive it runs out of control. And he did talk about the factors that limit and balance it and the importance of keeping those two things in balance. And you, the point that you seem to be making is that the balancing factors for one reason or another, we have lost.
Yes. Yes, we have. Smith was a psychologist, really. I mean, he is seen as a economist, but he was a professor of moral philosophy, a Scotsman who lived and worked in the 1700s. In fact, he published his great book, The Wealth of Nations, in 1776, and he was a great proponent of American independence, in fact. He's more, just as much an American in some ways as Thomas Jefferson and the rest of them. But what he clearly said, and you summarized it well, is that human initiative is the engine of commercial development, but it has to be contained within the social sentiment, as he called it, of those around us. In other words, people don't run away to greed because they have an equal force, which is to be loved by others. And so one tries to be, in one's ingenuity, helpful to the community at large. Of course, he was talking about small communities. In 1776, Boston had 10,000 people in it. And so now we've come to a totally different place, and yet we have still embraced his ideology as if it were perfect. And of course, it doesn't work as well now. We do not, usually when one develops a society which is reward-driven, which all market societies are, it's a natural evolution of our social behavior, then there is a countervailing force. And in most countries, it's a regulatory system which is essentially placed in there by common agreement through government forces. And we have tended to move away from that, as has England in the last 20 years. But most important, the deregulating factor was not just political, it was the birth of the internet and of our commercial hegemony in terms of its globalization. Because now, there are no limits. You know, the natural limits of sea and water and mountain, they've disappeared. We can now work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we can work all over the world. And so if we happen to be a grand commercial nation, as we are, driven by our own interests as migrants to to better ourselves and to better the world in which we live, suddenly we find ourselves out there with no reins. It's like riding a magnificent stallion, but having no bridle and no saddle.
Mm. Well, let me have you take this one step further, because some of the problems that we have identified, you will also find in other of the large Western industrialized countries. However, not to the extent we have them in the United States. It is much the problems that we identify and that we recognize are much worse, it seems, here in the United States, which would suggest that there is some kind of important difference, and you identify it, something that sets the United States apart from Britain, France, Germany, even though there are a lot of ways in which we are similar.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that is the migrant temperament. You see, we're self-selected. Even those who walked here 20,000 years ago came of their own volition, and most of us have come subsequently of our own volition. And the interesting thing is that only 2% of the world's population actually move in a migratory sense. Most individuals in the world live and die within about 50 miles of where they were born. So we are a self-selected population in a very precise way, and the way in which temperament evolves to shape a society and in a way that society then shapes us is very distinct here. We broke away from any tether early on, different from Canada and Australia and so on, and now there are 280 million of us, all of whom have essentially said we need to grasp the future for ourselves. We're a fascinating, a wonderful country, but I think we've run this experiment a little faster than some people. So in our affluence, we are in fact, as you said at the very beginning, at the edge of a very unusual experiment, which everybody else is going to experience too very soon in the industrialized West, especially. And so I think we have an obligation in some ways to step back and to ask ourselves, what is really going on? You know, some people see this book as critical of the American way. It's not at all. It is a critique, if you will, of where we've come in 200 years in our experiment. But I think as thoughtful, futuristic nation, we should be saying to ourselves, this is most interesting. Look at the bind we've got ourselves into in regards to eating, for example, or in terms of anxiety. Could we be doing something a little bit differently that in fact would bring us back to the balance of our civil society, which is what obviously the Foundation Fathers were looking for?
Yeah. We have a caller we get right to, and perhaps I should introduce again our guest for anybody who has just tuned in. We're talking with Dr. Peter Weibrow. He's a professor of psychiatry and biobehavioral science at UCLA and is the author of the book that explores these ideas. So if you'd like to read more and get into them in greater depth, you should look for the book. It's titled American Mania, When More Is Not Enough. It's just recently published by W.W. Norton. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's the number for Champaign-Urbana listeners. Toll free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Indiana on our toll free line 4. Hello.
Hello. When you first came on, I thought somehow you were going to throw a net over bipolarism and things like that. But you must be talking about, you've mentioned anxiety a couple of times.
Yeah.
And I remember reading that New York Times article myself and sitting back in my chair and saying, Jesus, the soccer women have won.
Yes.
And
you either what about the adolescents damaging themselves.
Yeah. You know, there's animals that do that. I think there were early studies on mice up in Canada. I don't know if it was heroin or morphine or what the world it was, but I know that it got to the place where they would rather do it than eat food that kept them alive.
Yeah.
Now, in a sense, expanding that kind of concept, I know it's sort of, I wish now I would have waited till more the end of the thing, because I really don't know where you're going about this. You know, you mentioned anxiety a couple times, and I guess I was, my perception was that you were going to designate a new, you know, sort of something that's going on.
No, I'm not into that ilk. I'm not saying that we're all manic. What I'm saying is that we live, the mania in this is really a metaphor. When you read the book, you'll realize that I use it really as an example of how we have entered into a corporate and a collective frenzy, in a sense. I mean, many of our corporations these days are sort of workaholic cults, and we're all pushing the edge constantly, fearing that we might lose in some competition. But that is largely a direct result of the reward-driven environment that we've built for ourselves, which is extremely successful commercially, but in fact is demanding of us probably things that we can't produce anymore in terms of the truncation of time that we have available for what we want to do, especially in terms of reinvestment into our families and communities, etc. So we've created for ourselves a very interesting imbalance. And, you know, in nature, it's balance that makes the important difference. I mean, one can certainly train oneself to take these young adolescents again to a peak, but to overtrain, then you begin to damage, especially in young people where development has not yet occurred. And you can see that in the same way in terms of our commercial exploitation of young people, because they, before they are formed in terms of their sense of the world, they are now the objects of considerable commercial development. You can't blame the merchant, I must add. I mean, we are franchising this as a society, and so we have to ask ourselves, what is it that we're doing, and what is the purpose of what we're doing in terms of the great myths and opportunities that we felt this nation had?
Yeah, okay. Well, thanks a lot.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. A bit ago, we were talking a little bit about what it is that makes America unique.
Yeah.
And how it is that some of the trends that we have seen, you can see them in other major industrial countries, but perhaps not quite to the extent yet that you see it in the United States. And
mm-hmm.
Your explanation that you offer is that it has something to do with the kind of spirit of this country that's rooted in the fact that we are largely a population of self-selected migrants, and that there is something there, there is a drive there that's operating that may be a little bit stronger in us than in other people. And so, and then to take a step back and to talk about why it is that this kind of drive is so difficult to turn off, you make the argument that that is in fact something that is hardwired in us that goes back a long way and might indeed account to some degree for the success of the human species.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we are quintessentially the survivalists on the planet. I mean, the migrant is the one who steps out ahead and is willing to go over the next hill and then looks at the next hill and says, well, we should take a look at that too, et cetera, et cetera. And we know, and I spend a lot of time in the book actually through a series of stories of various people that I meet, colleagues and others, talking about this and talking about the science of this, because there is a science to it. And I think that's one of the sobering facts, that if we understand the way in which science dictates and predicts this behavior, then we would be more thoughtful in our response to it. But just to take an example, we know that there are certain risk-taking temperaments, as we now call them. You might put it in another way and say this is a person who's interested in novelty, who's interested in going over the hill I was talking about. Those individuals we know have a different dopamine receptor system. Dopamine is the large superhighway of the brain that codes for activity and interest. It is, if you will, the fuel that drives the Adam Smith's engine of commercial adventure. But we know that there are a certain number of people, for example, if you look at the ancient migrations, the folks who walked the farthest are those who came into North and South America. They walked all the way from over many generations from North Africa, and they have a preponderance of something called the D47 allele, which allele, just a fancy word for variation, which means that this particular receptor has more repeats, protein repeats on it than the normal group of those in the brain. And that, interestingly enough, is the same gene as you find in people who we pejoratively call those who have attention deficits. Whereas, in fact, if you can imagine it, attention deficit just means a short attention span, unable to concentrate for very long. You could imagine if you were wandering across the plain, it would be pretty good to have a short attention span because you might want to keep looking behind you to make sure nothing was creeping up, etc. So we have got these built-in systems of survival which are very, very important to us. But now they're being engaged by a totally different environment. The other important point here is that we never have survived effectively alone. We have always survived in groups. If you look at the history of mankind, we are extraordinarily clever in our social behavior. And that is another part of the brain, which we now know a great deal about, which we learn through mimicry. It's very much like learning a language, and I go into that in some detail too. But these two things have to be in balance. And at the moment, we have a society we haven't quite figured out yet, the technically driven society, which drives the individual, but has very little in the way of feedback for the social group. Now, some people might say, isn't the internet helping us communicate? Yes, it is, but it's not helping us communicate in the organic sense that human beings like to communicate. You know, the old thing about AT&T, when you reach out to touch somebody, most people would prefer they be in the same room. And in fact, you learn from the experience of seeing and having empathy for others. In other words, watching the way they behave and mimicking that behavior. It's just the way we learn language. I learned English from my parents and the people I grew up with. If I'd grown up in France, I'd be speaking French. It's exactly the same with empathy and compassion. You learn it from those around you. And if you fragment the society, which is what we are in danger of doing now, that empathic balance to this reward cycle that we've been talking about is impaired. And that disability then, in the long run, has severe circumstances, which we are beginning to see, like irrational competition, for example, of young people at the age of 13 who are having three knee operations because they can't stand the pace in the football field.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else. We have a listener in Chicago who'd like to join in on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. I find your discussion very interesting, but I'm having a little problem with your genetic theory, because you making this real assumption about the United States. You said that this were people that chose to be here that migrated, but I am African American and my people were part of the forced migration. So then, how am I supposed to fit in this? Would I not have this allele? Or I mean, I just don't understand how you...
So you make a very good point, and in fact, it's been made by others. I was in Seattle about a week ago and speaking with Jerry Large, who's a very prominent and wonderful man there who writes for the Seattle Times, and he's also African-American. He asked the very same question.
Yeah.
And in fact, you're absolutely right that, of course, many African-Americans who've been here for generations were forced to come here, and in that sense, they have a different history in coming to this land. Now, whether or not that experiment as to how the allele plays out in various racial groups in this country has not been conducted in the recent past, but the important thing to remember is that what is called regression to the mean occurs. I'm not saying that everybody has this allele and probably many others that code for inquisitive behavior. What I am saying, and I, of course, this is not the only thing that drives human behavior.
Right.
What in fact I am saying, however, is that we have a disproportionate interest in the future, and there's no reason why those who were brought here in such tragic circumstances generations ago, those who managed to survive that ordeal, that terrible ordeal, probably have some of the wit and wisdom that we're talking about of others who survived the ordeal of the Holocaust and came here, etc. So there is a common thread, but I completely agree with you that it is not homogeneous, and I'm not saying that. One final point, however, is that you will notice that there's an internal migration in this country which is quite staggering and very different from most other industrialized and so-called, again, pejoratively, third world countries, where you do not see such migration. But I've, for just out of curiosity, in some of the lectures I've been giving, I would ask, you know, how many in the room actually are living 1,000 miles from where they were born? And it's quite remarkable that usually over 50% of the audience will put up their hands. So we have this is a very large country, but we have considerable internal migration as well as migration from outside. And I think, in general, we are a more curious, more optimistic, more interesting collection of people in many ways. But that's why I'm so passionate about being thoughtful about what we're doing to ourselves and making sure we don't destroy our wonderful experiment.
Well, I have one more question.
Yeah.
Much of that internal migration is driven by purely economics, which goes feeds back into your theory, but not in a genetic fashion, but simply in a socio-political fashion.
Sure.
The internal migration that we've had of African-Americans to the North, including my family, was purely driven mm-hmm. by economics. There was no curiosity or inquisitiveness. It was simply a purpose of survival. And much of the migration of whites over to the West in the 20s and 30s was very much the same way. So,
I agree with you, but I would differ a little bit in the sense that I think that if you think about it, most individuals who decide to move north or who decide to move west, they are the ones who decide to do that. Not everybody does it. And so there is, even in that example, something of a self-selection. But I entirely agree with you. I'm by no means a sort of biological reductionist. What I'm saying is that this is true if you think about temperament in general, the shy person has a different relationship to the world, and the world responds differently to a shy person than to an assertive, aggressive person. We see this in all sorts of things with experiments with children and so on. The one who sits behind the mother's skirts and the other who runs out and plays with everybody else's toys. So that this temperament will then code for a different cultural response. And I think you're absolutely right that we have to take into account, what I'm arguing that we should take into account now, which is the socio-cultural climate in which we live. We live in what has happened to us in the last 20 years is entirely driven by the environment. It's got nothing to do with the changing genome. All I'm saying is that in America, the reason why we have come to the edge of this a little earlier than most people is partly because of our inquisitive behavior, which is basically very good. And so I think we would, if we had more time, and obviously we don't, we would find easily that we're on the same wavelength here.
We are, and I think what's distracting to me is that I think that biological argument takes away from what the very important things you're saying about the sociocultural environment.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think, you know, the book has... It doesn't set itself as a political treatise, but it does certainly has socio-political implications, and I don't shy away from those. I think we're doing some things radically wrong at the moment that we need to reevaluate in terms of our socio-political climate.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We're a little bit past the midpoint here, and I will introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. We're talking with Dr. Peter Wybrow. He is a psychiatrist. He is on the faculty of University of California in Los Angeles, where he is the Judson Braun Distinguished Professor and Executive Chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Biobehavioral Sciences at the Geffen School of Medicine. He's an international authority on depression and manic depressive disease. He's the author of a number of books, including A Mood Apart, The Thinker's Guide to Emotion and Its Disorder, and the book that explores the ideas that we're talking about here this morning. And that book is rather new, titled American Mania, When More Is Not Enough. It's published by W.W. Norton. And if you're interested, you could seek it out in the bookstore. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. If we do really believe that generally speaking, human beings as a species are characterized by a certain kind of curiosity, a drive to explore, to know what's over the next hill, that some people may have at a genetic level a kind of an adventure gene or a novelty-seeking gene, all of that, and maybe has helped us to succeed as a species. I wonder why it is. You could imagine that if that indeed is part of our programming, that we could be able to channel that now, even today, into avenues that would be more productive and creative and positive. Why is it, though, that seems to get channeled into activities that ultimately are not and might even be self-destructive?
Well, I don't think we do it exclusively in a self-destructive way, and I don't think we do it intentionally. In fact, of course, our inquisitiveness and our curiosity has been one of the great engines of human discovery, and particularly so in the U.S. I mean, the U.S. has a disproportionate number of the Nobel laureates in the last few years. We have great science. We have, at the top end, we have amazing medicine industry. The software industry is one of the finest, perhaps the leading edge of the world. So our inquisitiveness, in fact, pays extremely well. It's just that when we build into it this reward cycle, which then we have this ideology that we must continue to grow the market every year, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that inquisitiveness then comes into a interesting loop, which I explore in American Mania, where we are continuously inundated with novelty, because that's the way in which we are able to sell more goods. The brain pays very much attention to novelty. That's what we're wired to look at. As I was saying earlier, we are sort of turned off by boredom quite quickly. And so we have learned, the merchant has learned, that, and so has the politician, actually, that you can increase people's attention by giving them what they want rather than depriving them of things. So, you know, we don't have a war tax at the moment. We're pretending that which we should have, probably, we're pretending that the war in Iraq can be as a one-time item so we can keep it outside the budget. I mean, this sort of interesting confusion about what we're doing is, I think, tied to the fact that we are now very much individualists, and we would hate the idea that we would have to give anything up from the individual level to reinvest in the social order. But it's the inquisitive nature of ourselves which has put us in this place in the first place. I wouldn't see it as entirely negative, though, that as you were inferring in your question there, David.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone else here in the someone in the Chicago area on our line 4, toll-free line.
Thank you.
Yes, hello.
What I'd like to ask is, you mentioned that the attitude of people is important, and I wanted to bring in the Japanese attitude, which is to accept change. That's one of their main thoughts, and I'd like to know if you could elaborate a little bit on that, how that might affect their attitude.
Yes, the Japanese are a very interesting comparative group of people, actually, because, you know, they're very homogeneous. They do not have the risk-taking temperament that we have in this country. And, of course, they work extremely hard. But from my discussions with folks who know the culture better than I, they work in a way that is not as innovative as the U.S. This may be a stereotype, but I think that that's probably true. But they also have a much greater collective concern, and
they're more cooperative.
Yes, they're more collectively interested in determining outcome. And so, you know, although we have in the last few years suggested that Japan is, ironically, because at first it looked as if their collective adventure was going to outstrip the U.S. In the last few years, we've said increasingly, well, their economy is not growing as it should. If you talk to people from Japan, they don't find this particularly a problem. They save a lot of money compared to the U.S. They feel themselves in a fairly stable situation. And so I think the culture is an interesting opposite to our own. We tend not to invest in the collective good, but rather in the individual good. And the problem for both countries is that maybe Japan's a little too much on the collective and we're a little too much on the individual.
Well, what about
the balance,
Latino,
between the two is what counts.
What about the Latino aspect? They have a lot of cooperativeness. They try to help each other, and I think that that's a very good quality, and maybe there something should be said about that.
I didn't hear the first part of your question. I'm sorry.
Well, the Latino people.
The Latino people, yes.
Yes.
Well, there again.
They are very cooperative,
yes,
with each other. They try to make each other successful.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, the Latino community have a stronger family structure, especially in the early times of their migration. You see this in many inner city areas. You see it in Miami. You see it in Los Angeles, that in fact the strong family structure enables the groups to move quite quickly up the socioeconomic scale. And that is, again, I think, an example of how initiative and social reinvestment working hand in hand is a better paradigm than either a collectivism, which of course we're phobic about in this country because we think it's communism, compared to individualism, which if it goes too far, then begins to destroy the community which gives it life in the future generations.
They're cooperative rather than being competitive.
Yes, yes. I mean, competition is good, but human beings love to compete, but it's called, and I agree with you, it's what I call collaborative competition. In other words, we compete in a way that a small market, which used to be the hub of our social behavior, competes, where the local merchants, you know, three of them are making boots, then the one that makes the boots best and the one that is willing to give the best service eventually slowly outruns the others. And that's the way the interlacing relationships of a market should really work. Unfortunately, now we've decentralized our markets, decentralized them in the sense of being in the local community. Many of the market forces that Adam Smith thought were the natural balance to individual initiative and eventually to greed, they have gone away. And so the markets are different now from what they were. And we see that in the unfortunate examples of Enron and all the other difficulties that we've been having in these huge corporations.
I want to thank the caller, and I have several people. In fact, the lines are full, and we're getting into our last 15 minutes, so I want to make sure I get some more callers here. But it sounds now, with the kind of turn the conversation has taken, that is the bottom line here, the problem we're talking about, is it unbridled individualism?
That's part of it. I think that we have got to the point where we've built a society which is so attractive to the individual that, and it has diminished through the. I spend a lot of effort on trying to analyze the way in which time has been crunched in our society. As time has diminished and we have little time to spread around because we're so busy paying off our debts or doing whatever you said at the very beginning, The individualism is reinforced, and it's also reinforced by the fact that we have all these novelties out there to choose from. Believe it or not, there are 1,250 forms of hair shampoo you can buy in the store. The average grocery store has something like 30,000 items from which to choose. In this sort of affluence, it's very difficult to have to get off the individual treadmill and to reinvest in the collective, as the last caller was talking about.
We have other callers. Let's go to someone here on a cell phone. Line number one. Hello. The caller there, line one.
Ah, they have the same problem with their cell phone as I do.
Maybe so. All right, let's try caller here, line two, near Effingham. Hello.
Yeah, I wanted to comment a little bit about the Japanese.
Yes.
I went through there, went on the way to Korea.
Yes.
And I couldn't believe how polite these people were after all the things they did in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Like the port I landed at was Camp Sasebo, where they had the two-man submarines, and they sent out to sip those ships, and they knew they wasn't coming back, you know, suicide missions. But I give a lot of credit to General Eisenhower or MacArthur, and I said he got those people a 120 degree turnaround.
Mm-hmm.
And Ben's Illinois has got a undefeated basketball team. I just wondered how much the coach had of this mind over body theory.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted you to comment about how the interaction and how these guys get along together, because I don't think they've got any better personnel than a lot of other teams.
Well, yeah, I think mind over body, it's almost, you're quite correct, sir. I think that you know, the mind controls the body, in fact, and that's what we're really talking about, in the sense that if, take hunger, for example, if you don't regulate your hunger, you don't understand your hunger, then the chances are that it will, your body will be overfed, and then you'll be in really bad trouble, especially if you don't take any physical exercise. But in terms of basketball, I'm not any expert there. I'm sure you're much more than I. But I've been impressed recently by some of the teams that have tended to focus upon not the individual stars, but upon the functioning of the team. And very often they come out well, as we've seen in some of the national competitions. So again, what I think we need to learn from our history as human beings is that individualism is very, very important. But stable social orders, stable social relationships are also important. And I guess if you understand the way in which the neurobiology of the body works, then what I'm arguing is that we should be more mindful in understanding these things, in applying them when we try to think about the way in which society should be set up. For example, we have many, many social programs, I think, but they're fragmented. They're not, we haven't thought through what sort of social programs do we really need to help support the young woman and the young man, for example, who are growing a new family and are perhaps both out of work. These are the sorts of things that we need to think about, recognizing what it is that we need as human beings, rather than trying just to fit ourselves into this light-speed culture we've built.
Let's go to another caller. This is next, someone in Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, what about the incident of anxiety and depression when we compare, individual society versus collective? I would assume that in our society, we have tremendous increases, don't we?
We do, actually. You're quite right. The interesting thing there, sir, is that if you look at the recent epidemiological studies in anxiety and you look at them by date of birth, in other words, what scientists call cohorts, as you probably are familiar with, the latest cohorts, the ones born after 1966 and perhaps even more in the most recent birth group, those individuals have a massive increase in anxiety and depression compared to those born before that period, which suggests that, you know, that obviously nothing has changed in the genetics. What we're talking about here is a demanding environment which is shifting the way in which we live, and therefore shifting the stress we're under, and that is expressed in the form of anxiety. The other interesting thing, I think, apropos of some of the questions for today, is that when you look at individuals stratified in terms of socioeconomic income, socioeconomic grouping and income, those who families who have over $150,000 a year in income, it looks increasingly as if the adolescents in those groups have more stress, they are more anxiety-ridden, they have more suicidal ideation, and they generally are unhappier than kids whose families have a median income of about $50,000. So it looks, again, as David was saying at the very beginning of his program, it looks as if there is now... when you go beyond a certain point in affluence, the demand that it takes to support that affluence very often begins to have a negative side effect in terms of both mentation and physiological balance.
Thank you.
All right. Back, I think, probably to the person on the cell phone that we're trying to get there. Line number 1. Hello.
Thank you.
Yes.
I enjoy this, and I'm glad to see you stressing the fact that we're biological beings and much of what we're doing is driven by that. So in light of that, and in light of the fact that the American society is enriched for risk takers, if you will, as you outlined, and the leadership is probably the most accomplished in terms of achieving things, how do you propose to restore the balance? Because after all, if you try and get society to stress more communal support and a more balanced biological system, the people that have really benefited from the current system are the leaders, and they are unlikely to want to move away from a system that has benefited them so well. So
right.
how can we
so
restore the balance?
I agree with you. And a couple of thoughts about that. Take it in two parts. First, one individual that I, when I was in New York last week, suggested, and I hadn't thought of it myself, but when you give it some thought, it's an interesting idea. He said, well, why not bring back the Sabbath or the Sunday? That you remember those days, perhaps you don't, but I do.
I do. You're
when,
right.
When the shops were closed on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the grocery store would be open for a couple of hours. You can get some milk if you really have made a mess of planning for your week. But in general, and certainly it was true when I was growing up in England, England's now very much like the U.S., shops were closed on Wednesday afternoons and on Sunday. The fact is that that has two effects. It doesn't, I'm sure there'd be a commercial outrage, but the fact is that it enables individuals to reinvest in that social organization which we all hold sacred, which is the family and the extended community efforts. It isn't such a bad idea when you begin to think about it. I mean, bring back the blue laws, in other words, basically, he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
Another thought is that I absolutely agree with you about we've reached a tipping point, to use a common phrase these days, in regards to our social individual balance. You see, most societies, as they get more complex, like we are, tend to use regulatory systems to offset the dive towards individualism, which of course is easily driven, as we would discuss throughout this program. So, but interestingly enough, and this is what you see in many European countries. We won't want to go into that because of the time. But the interesting thing here in America is that many of the regulatory systems that have been put in place recently have actually fed the corporate side of the ledger, which is the one that tends to focus upon individualism, because that's the way in which the market is driven, if you'll follow my argument. So
yes.
Take the Medicare law, for example. I mean, that does not actually enable older people very much. What it does is it sucks $800 billion out of the tax base, and it essentially enables pharmaceutical companies to still charge essentially what they wish, and I would submit that that is not a regulatory function that returns balance to the community. I think we may be beginning to see the same thing in terms of Social Security. That is not a crisis, but it is being made into a crisis so that we can put more on the individual side of the ledger. This is an ideology, and an ideology is fine as long as it has roots which I think are practical and sensible. But what I'm arguing is, if you understand the neurobiology of human beings and you understand Adam Smith's original theory, this is an ideology which has lost its roots. It now is off on a canter of its own, and we are in fact doing things which are further damaging our civil society, which is what really is my great passion. I think that we need to reconsider what it is that America really was looking for 200 years ago when we set up this this great society. It certainly wasn't, Jim, just buying a new refrigerator.
I am in complete agreement with you. I've enjoyed this. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. It does seem that we have a real serious problem here in our tendency, not just both personally and perhaps as a society, to use material well-being as an indicator of our general well-being.
Yes, you know,
that
you're
is, we
right.
don't that we don't seem to have. You know, we have our leading economic indicators, but we don't seem to have any leading emotional health indicators.
I couldn't agree with you more, David. Yeah. I think that's one of the dangers that unless we face it, and I think this is why some people find me to be critical of the American way. Not at all. Actually, I am a deep defender of the American way and of the individualism and of the great sense we have of being a nation that can be a beacon of light to others. But we are only going to be that if we have a balance in our civil society. And I think in our materialism, we've confused the pursuit of our material pleasures. Goodness sake, I love material pleasures just like everybody else. The fact is that we've confused that pursuit with the mythological pursuit of happiness, which comes largely from social balance and the opportunity for people to move easily within the society. You know, we pride ourselves on being a very socially mobile society. A couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, in The Economist had an interesting article. That's not a left-wing magazine, as most people know. It had a very interesting article which showed very clearly that our mobility in the U.S. is now, social mobility, is now less for most individuals than it is in Europe. In other words, if you're born in the lower 60-70% of folks socioeconomically, your chances of moving up compared to your parents, but either in a material sense or in any other sense, are very limited. Only in the top 5 or 10% is there still some social mobility. So some of our mythologies are being collapsed against our present turmoil, yeah, and I think we need to review that.
We are going to have to stop. We've used our time. The book is American Mania, When More Is Not Enough, published by W.W. Norton, by our guest Peter Wybrow, W-H-Y-B-R-O-W, if you go look for the book. And Dr. Wybrow, thanks very much for talking.
Thank you so much, David.